Hello, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Stinging Fly podcast. I'm Danny Denton, and I'm the editor of the Stinging Fly magazine. Every month, we ask a writer to delve into our archive and to select and read a piece from it that they've admired. This month, our guest is Conor O'Callaghan. Conor O'Callaghan is a writer from Newry, County Down, who grew up in Dundalk, and he has written two novels, Nothing on Earth, which was published in 2016, and We Are Not in the World, which will be published early in 2021. He's also the author of five collections of poetry, the last of which was live streaming, and of course the brilliant Red Mist, Roy Keane and the Football Civil War, about which we'll say nothing for fear of digging up old wounds. Conor has taught writing for quite a while now, holding various prestigious posts. He currently lectures in writing at Sheffield Hallam University. Conor, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Not bad, Danny. Nice to be here. Enjoying the second wave of lockdown and self-isolation.
How has it been for you? How is the whole pandemic experience?
It's fine. It's, to be honest, like most writers, I find that my life hasn't changed massively. I've got two kids in their 20s, a daughter is 24 and a son is 25, and I think their lives have changed. I mean, a whole year has been knocked out of their lives. My life is fairly solitary anyway. I saw Kevin Barry saying the same thing in the Irish Times. So I actually found it, to be honest, a little bit galling. I live in England. And I did find it a little bit galling that suddenly we had all these people on the radio telling us how to self-isolate. I have, you know, devoted...
We've been self-isolating for years.
I've devoted most of my life to self-isolation. And suddenly all over Radio 4 were these Johnny-come-latelys telling me how to self-isolate. There were sort of bullet point lists appearing in newspapers about how to self-isolate. And I kind of thought, I don't need to be told this. I've been doing this all my life. It's been fine. I've actually got some work done and I've gotten over the fact that my second novel was delayed a year as a result of COVID-19.
Yes, I was going to say that one of my books of 2020 was We Are Not in the World, but of course it's no longer a book of 2020. It's going to be a book of 2021.
Well, actually, you know, the weird thing, Danny, is it was printed when the decision, the correct decision by Penguin, the people at Penguin and Doubleday, when the decision was taken to shelve the publication for a year, the book was already printed. So I actually have it sitting in my room, and it's been sitting up in my room for a year. I was actually kind of, I became fascinated with the publication history as a result of this with Flann O'Brien's At Swim Two Birds, which was published in London 2 weeks or something before the outbreak of World War II. A couple of copies got sold. It was all piled back into boxes of the publishing house Longmans. And then the offices of Longmans were bombed. And the book just completely disappeared off the face of the earth and didn't actually resurface. A book that was originally published in 1939 didn't actually resurface into any kind of proper recognition until 1965, I think it was. It was one of these kind of lost books. And I found myself wondering if there are going to be books that are sort of the lost texts of the coronavirus.
So does this mean when the book comes out, you're just going to go to bed for 24 years or something like that?
I feel as if, do you know what it is? I feel as if the book has happened. Do you know? I feel as if the book has happened. I love the book and I love the production of the book, and I'm still quite excited of the possibility of it being out in the world. But as far as I'm concerned, the publication date was April 2020. And I still,
that's what's written
while
on the
I recognize here. Factually that that's not correct, I suppose in some sense, kind of psychologically or imaginatively, I still think that it happened then. But there was only one copy of it available, and that's still sitting in my study upstairs.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about it, because it's like I remember a similar build up, like obviously books come out at a particular time. So April 2020, this was to come out. but it was written quite a while before that. Even the final edits and things were done. There are long lead-in times now, so it's not like you finished it in March, expected it to go in April, and now you've got to wait. You'd already been waiting, or certainly I had that experience of waiting for 14, 15 months or something to see my book on a bookshelf.
It was quite close between one and the other, but usually, yeah, it does take a long time. I think it was finished around about October 2019. So it wasn't that long a wait, but even then, you know, by the time the publication date comes around, you're kind of ready to go.
Yeah.
And it found, I suppose one of the things that I found difficult was that, I mean, what happens is when you publish a book, it clears the space imaginatively for you to do other stuff.
Yeah.
You get this clean slate that is terrifying, but it's also really exciting and inspiring as well. I suppose when the thing was shelved, I didn't entirely have that clean slate.
Yeah.
I found myself thinking, okay, is this, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was absolutely the right thing to do. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt the wisdom of doing it. So it'll come out next February.
Mm, but it doesn't make it easy. It doesn't make it easy, does it? So February, yeah, we'll everybody put a note in your diary for 2021.
My book will be coming out in all its unfathomable darkness. We'll be launched upon a world in need of positive vibes. Holy God.
And we'll come, I'd love to actually talk a little bit about the book later in the podcast. I suppose we better get to the business at hand as well, though. What piece from our archive have you chosen to read?
I chose the essay memoir, Suddenly a Duck, by Claire Louise Bennett. I mean, I came across it, I think it was published in 2015, and I did come across it at the time. I suppose the interesting thing about it from my perspective is that my wife actually taught in Roehampton College, which Claire Louise Bennett talks about very unflatteringly. And yes, my wife taught there in the period that Claire Louise Bennett talks about. So when we read it for the first time, my wife was absolutely horrified because she's talking about Roehampton College, 1994. And my wife, Mary Peace, who teaches the 18th century, was teaching there. It was her first sort of part-time job as an academic.
So I wonder if we could get Mary to write a response essay to this one. Very interesting. But yeah, you'll read the essay for us, Connor, and we'll have a good chat about it afterwards.
Suddenly a Duck. I left home and moved to London in 1994 in order to begin a degree at a small, not very reputable college in Roehampton. Despite having attained good grades in my three A-level subjects, I did not satisfy the precise requirements stipulated by Queen Mary of Westfield College, my first choice, and therefore suffered the indignity of having to go through clearing, which involved resentfully sourcing the index of available university places published in the back pages of The Guardian and making last-minute calls to the various listed and lackluster institutions with the galling optimism that some quivering milksop hadn't beat me to the post. I was incensed that Queen Mary of Westfield's refused me entry, since in terms of points, my grades were equivalent to what they'd asked for. I pointed this out to the woman on the phone in the admissions office and to the man on the phone in the English department, added to which I said, with much emphasis and incredulity, when I at last had the attention of the faculty itself, I got an A in English and you only asked for B, and English is the very subject I wish to study. They'd wanted Bs in all three subjects, and this would have worked out just fine, I often suppose, had I not gone into an enormous pickle with my philosophy teacher, which meant that from time to time, attending class was quite impossible, and as such I wound up scraping a C grade. You ought to have done much better than that, he said in the pub on results day, and I felt like shoving him with all my might into the people standing in a tight-knit, mirthful group directly behind him. On the other hand, one of my English teachers was absolutely flabbergasted that I had pulled off the top mark in that subject and openly opined that I must have cheated. I don't quite see how it's possible to cheat in English, really, but perhaps it is. Occasionally, you can blag your way through areas of specific ignorance, and this I often did, but overall, you have to have the capacity to connect with the written word and the wherewithal to understand and relate that involvement, whatever its nature might be. In other words, if literature has the force to shape you, not your beliefs necessarily or even your outlook, but something far more intimate and formative, the sorts of men you are drawn to, for example, and the way you experience desire, then objective analysis seems trite and becomes rather irrelevant. The value of continuing to study this most perspicacious of disciplines at such a woefully mediocre institute, where the caliber of my fellow students was generally very poor and the standard of teaching excruciatingly patchy, was negligible. And I very quickly felt frustrated and horrified that I'd ended up there. In order to give vent to these huge barging feelings, I would either archly refuse to say a word during seminars, or I would set forth close readings that were complex, persuasive, and entirely erroneous. I had some rather fanciful ideas about what studying literature at university would entail, the sorts of mellow rooms I'd pass through, the views I'd come upon, the crepuscular light, the animated hush, the slinking patina and reoccurring ferronnière, the bicycles and small bridges, everything on the turn, and most of all the sharp and charming people I'd meet. In fact, as it turned out, many of them liked nothing more than to sit in the middle of their beds in the middle of the day, watching Australian soap operas cross-legged with the door wide open. "Do you want a cup of tea?" they would sometimes ask, when I occasionally leant up against the doorframe and scowled within. "No" would be the invariable reply. Then I'd carry on down the corridor, possibly with the intention of having a very long bath in the bathroom right at the end. For the first year, I lived out my unjust circumstances in the halls of residence, you see. The first time I saw Digby Stewart Halls of Residence was the day I arrived with my aunt and her boyfriend and moved into one of its titchy, freshly painted rooms. I'm not sure what images prior to that I might have seen of the building, possibly something in a brochure. Perhaps they'd sent a belated prospectus, I don't remember. There was nothing unexpected about its appearance in any case. It was several stories high, was compiled of red brick, and had many windows going across left to right from where I stood anyway. I don't remember who greeted us or what the procedure was for being allocated and shown to a particular room. But I recall there were two keys, one for the main door below and another for unlocking my room up on the second floor. I'm not sure what happened in the event of mislaying keys, which is surprising, because I'm sure I must have forgotten them fairly often. Probably it was very easy to access the dormitories. I remember going up into the dormitories in the opposite building with no great difficulty. One of the advantages of being in a small shambolic college was that although there were rules and so on, they weren't assiduously enforced, and so everything was near to hand without too much rigmarole, including the college hardship fund. The very first thing I did was to plug into my stereo and put on a record, one of my mother's, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. My aunt and her boyfriend hadn't hung about, so I was blessedly free to get on with unpacking without any upbeat interference. There was no one to tell me that one thing could go there and another thing ought to go here. And maybe where I elected to perch my kettle was precarious. I seem to remember that the shelf above it did begin to blister and peel after a while, but that might have been due to candles. Very soon after moving in, it occurred to me that many things in the room would be much improved if they were completely gold. So I bought a spray can of dark gold paint and set to work. I know quite a few objects receive the Midas touch, but the only thing I can visually recall is a mug, which now looked like a key prop in a gloomy Jacobean play about fealty and folly or whatever, added to which the tea didn't taste at all right. I didn't drink coffee then, but I'm sure if I did, that would also have had tasted plumbiferous and barbed. It wasn't a very big room, none of them were, and it was mostly a very untidy room, probably because I grew up in various houses that were all scrupulously clean and neat as a new pin. My mother was forever painting the banister or varnishing the front step or standing on the floorboards or scratching glass off the window pane with a Wilkinson sword razor blade. One day, just before I left, a duck appeared above the toilet cistern in the bathroom at home. It was pretty quirky compared to everything else, and it came all of a sudden, all at once. I wonder what else my mother might have painted. Beside the duck, the only other thing I remember her depicting were some flowers on a pair of stout green boots I wore to death. She used lots and lots of oil paint, so the effect was very artistic and not the least bit fey. Amazingly, it was permissible to smoke in the dorms, and I often smoked in bed. I think everyone probably did because no one got up terribly early, and it was quite normal to skulk back off to bed for a while in the afternoon. Overall, I had some pretty disgraceful habits. For instance, I'd shimmy up onto my sink and take a pee in it during the night. Each time I did, I vowed it would be the last, mostly because I saw it would be quite the catastrophe if the sink fell off the wall. How would I explain that to the nuns, I wondered, as I wiggled my bottom further into the chilly, incommodious basin. There were nuns, yes. There was a pair of dead nuns buried in a vault, which I never went down to see, and two nuns upstairs. And even though they moved about a bit, I never saw them either. At one time, Digby Stewart College had been a college of the Sacred Heart, and many vestiges of its Catholic past remained disarmingly intact. Apparently, Vivian Lee had been a pupil here, and the reason I remember that is because at around the same time, maybe a year or two before, I read that Vivian Lee had been a drunk and indiscriminate nymphomaniac, too wide-ranging for Laurence Olivier to handle. And in later years, the book tells the reader, she lifted tramps from off the street and jostled them into hedgerows in order to have sex with them. It strikes me now that this was doubtlessly a lot of exaggerated nonsense. I don't recall where exactly I read it. Perhaps it was in one of those mawkish MGM movie annuals my grandmother had so many of, which aggrandize acquisitive men and demonize enterprising women. In all likelihood, Vivian Lee was very probably fairly bonkers, but why and how are not simple, sensational matters. And I was genuinely grateful for her unlikely association with this otherwise second-rate, vaguely papal institute and its run-of-the-mill denizens. The bathrooms were very basic and quite austere, not unlike what you might expect to find in an early Victorian asylum, or even earlier Swiss convent. I thought it was quite beautiful and seemed natural to make prolonged visits almost every day. It was cold sometimes, very cold. The mirrors were frameless and thin. The tiles were white and the stark taps a devil to turn. The water that untwisted out of them, however, was clear and tapered and soundless as fresh brown glass. There were showers, of course, but I almost never used them. I preferred to take a bath, and I think there were two of them, though there may have been only one. Certainly there was one, in a room with a sloping ceiling and an off-kilter wooden chair beside it. It was a very deep enamel bath, somewhat discoloured, and the water that billowed from the hot tap was scalding. I read somewhere that Sylvia Plath's bath with water was just about as hot as she could possibly stand it, and I was the same. I drew baths that were so hot I got giddy right away and thought I'd pass out and perhaps drown. It was painful. Indeed, it was a time when I was finding out about all sorts of pain, some of it methodical and self-imposed. The bath was where I felt private and absolutely away from everything. And perhaps I pretended some things while I was there. Perhaps I pretended I was in an asylum with nothing much to do, no expectation upon me. Or perhaps I imagined I was a maid in a big house doing her ablutions on a dim Sunday evening before a rapid and somewhat violent assignation with Sir halfway up the furthermost stairwell. I think the thoughts I had then probably weren't so very different from the kind of thoughts I have now, meandering, unconnected, purposeless, and slightly grubby. There were periods, increasing in duration and tenacity, when living in halls was unbearable due to the proximity of other people. If no one saw you for a day or two, everyone would get very excited and someone would thump on your door high up and intone your name rather heroically. I'm not sure what it was they were all worked up about. The dormitory walls were so slight you could hear your neighbour's toaster pop, and I nearly always had music on. So although unseen, I would have been perfectly audible. It wasn't possible anyway to be alone in a building like that. So I spent more and more time at one of the two nearby pubs, the King's Head and the Black Cat. Farther away was the Arab Boy, but I didn't frequent that particular establishment with regularity until the following year. We seldom went to the Green Man. I'm not sure why, since it was in fact very close to Putney Heath, which is where I went to live the following year. I saw a man on a horse once on Putney Heath. He was dressed in silver-red livery, had a weapon on his enormous sauntering back, and the hooves of his drizzling horse left no trace in the snow. It was a foggy afternoon. There was a pail of vomit next to the back door. I don't think it was there when I moved in, but once it was there, it was difficult to remember a time when it hadn't been. It froze right through the winter and returned to its original gruely consistency in spring. Behind the row of houses was an ancient road which most people accessed through a gate in their garden fence. The setup at our house, however, was somewhat less orthodox. There was a vile shed out the back that was black with fire damage and rot, and one flailed about in a diabolical amalgam of charred remains and slippery decay before staggering out onto the ancient road. Once or twice, when I was in a particularly triumphant mood, I gave the bucket of sick a swift, jolly kick before charging into the kitchen through the back door, which no one ever bothered to lock. I threw furniture and broke things, or they smashed. Someone I became acquainted with at the time and who I still know maintains, I flicked a chest of drawers across a room with just two fingers. I drank a lot of Lapsang Souchong then and would often leave mugs of it unfinished here or there so that when the surface of a piece of furniture plunged vertical, several mugs went right along with it, flinging these perfectly round velvet tapestries of mould up ahead until they flapped and landed like creepy little dollies along the bookshelves. And I drew on the walls, nothing sinister, waves mostly. With a piece of blue cue chalk, I slipped off a pool table into my pocket at the King's Head one evening. Wave after wave, each mightier than the last, till last a ninth one gathering half the deep and full of voices slowly rose and plunged, roaring, and all the wave was in a flame. My friend from Nuremberg, who lived a few doors down, lent me a copy of The Female Malady, and I took notes from it in the afternoon while I wrenched at pistachios and drank Ribena through a tiny straw. I collected tokens from the Verbena carton, which was very organized of me, and eventually received a free Dino bubble watch for my efforts. I was very pleased with this until somehow inexplicably Dino turned over. His underneath was flat and pale blue and entirely featureless. And despite patiently flipping that watch over and over, ankles crossed and a cigarette sloped in my free hand, in a kind of relaxing, dogged trance, Dino never came back round and was eventually buried beneath the bedside heap of sliding pistachio shale. The things I read in the book my German friend lent me shot right in beneath my skin, into that place between the nerves, which is not me or even mine, that unseparate place where my grandmother and my great-grandmother are softly present, like supple shadows overlapping in an alcove. I was aware from a young age that both my grandmother and her mother had been taken into psychiatric units, where they underwent brutal corrective treatment for behavior that was considered irksome and abnormal. In his introduction to Yonichiro Tanizaki's essay In Praise of Shadows, Charles Moore reminds us that one of the basic human requirements is the need to dwell, and one of the central human acts is the act of inhabiting, of connecting ourselves, however temporarily, with a place on the planet which belongs to us and to which we belong. In the third year of my time in London, the importance of academic achievement began to wane. Discovering how to live, how to inhabit the world, was a more urgent and engrossing assignment. I became very inquisitive about the contents of other people's kitchen cupboards and bathroom cabinets, an interest that endures, though less avidly, even now. But home is not simply a concrete carapace where we cook and clean. And it doesn't matter how accomplished we become in those areas, they will not, on their own, engender a sense of belonging. In the third and final year, I rented a large bedsit on Wandsworth Common. I had a place of my own at last and rarely left it. I would sit for a long time looking up at the pipes that slipped through the walls into the room, moved along the wall and disappeared out of it, onwards to somewhere else I did not see and could not get to. These pipes, these slender interlopers, threatened and beguiled me. What a wonderful, elegant thing is a pipe, shifting in and out, up and down throughout the building, not ending here, not beginning here, showing only a little of its passage. They seemed so important sometimes and so graceful, the most graceful, resolute entity in here. And they were so high up and opaque that sometimes their indifference was sort of unbearable. And I wished in a way that I was a spider so I could see the ghostly dust on their back and perhaps make something of my own up there. Often, the home is thought of and assessed in terms of its domestic capacity, but there are other ways of interpreting and experiencing our corner of the world, and Tanizaki's beautiful book is an invitation to reimagine the purpose and feel of our intimate surroundings. I suppose I shall sound terribly defensive if I say that Westerners attempt to expose every speck of grime and eradicate it, while we Orientals carefully preserve and even idealize it. Yet for better or worse, we do love things that bear the marks of grime, soot and weather, and we love the colours and the sheen that call to mind the past that made them. Tanizaki's sensitive, idiosyncratic appraisal contrasts the Western predilection for light-filled rooms, sparkling appliances and spotless surfaces with the Japanese tradition, which favours darkness, patina, lacquer and frailty, what Tanizaki refers to as the glow of grime. Rather than fear shadows and banish them as we do in the West, the Japanese, Tanizaki tells us, discovered how to guide shadows towards beauty's end. These cultural preferences are not simply a matter of style, but are indicative of attitudes to light and dark on a deeper level. It demonstrates a willingness to live cheek by jowl with phantoms, mysteries, the ancient, the chimerical. The home then is not so much a boundaried static place that is closed off and impervious to external influence. According to Tanizaki's wonderfully evocative descriptions, Japanese rooms are permeable and transmogrifying, infinitely capable of luring one into a state of reverie. When everything is illuminated and the shadows have been sanitized, where goes the creature inside, and what happens to her daydreams? As the home becomes more domesticated and increasingly familial, when convenience replaces ritual and spotlights replace shades, some cosmic link is surely arrested, and the house is no longer a threshold to other worlds. The house then is nothing, just an isolated, distorted edifice, tethered to its functions and possessions. And whomever lives inside there is bewildered to feel such a deep, abiding estrangement in a place where she is supposed to feel protected, inspired, and at ease. Perhaps she takes to her bed. Perhaps she throws furniture. Perhaps she draws on the walls. Perhaps there is suddenly a dock. Perhaps one day she simply leaves. Ungrateful creature that she is. In the exam halls at the end of that final year, my performance was generally less than enthusiastic, and that was fine. This was a time for fantasy and nightmares, for immersion and flight. In my own rooms, I had begun to understand how to live with darkness. The blackness within you is stilled, is transfixed perhaps, when it has in its gaze the blackness without, what Tanizaki describes as the visible darkness. That mesmerizing, preternatural and granular place where always something seemed to be flickering and shimmering. This was the darkness in which ghosts and monsters were active, and indeed was not the woman who lived in it, behind layer after layer of screens and doors. Was she not of a kind with them? To be sure, merging with the dark in all its primitive and transformative potency is somewhat destabilizing. Even so, it is surely possible, as Tanizaki says, to guide shadows to beauty's end. And it seems to me entirely indefensible that anyone ever thought it good and necessary to send an electric current blazing through the furrows of someone else's mind in order to dazzle the essential blackness into rapid extinction.
That was Suddenly a Duck, an essay by Claire Louise Bennett, read beautifully by Conor O'Callaghan there, that appeared in issue 31 of The Stinging Fly, better known as the London issue, in the summer of 2015. Claire Louise Bennett is the author of Pond, published by The Stinging Fly Press and Fitzcarraldo Editions, and also Fish Out of Water, published by Juxta Press. Conor, I'm struck listening to you read that. Again, after I had read it myself or reread it, how full of life that essay is. It's just brimming with feeling, thought, experience. Yeah. What drew you to it?
I mean, I suppose one of the things that I was thinking reading it was how incredibly experiential the writing is. And I suppose that's the thing that I value most in the best writing, is writing that it is not simply the record of experience, but is also itself an experience. There's a density, a complexity to the language, but there's also great wit. I found myself laughing reading it. Mm. It's deceptively funny. It does loads of stuff that conventional good writing doesn't do. And I think in that respect, it's tremendously brave in the best possible sense. It's amazing. I mean, some of the phrases, I was just in awe of some of the phrases and some of the passages just reading through it.
Joe, what's remarkable, I think, is like when you're writing fiction, there's always the awareness of, in terms of that experiential thing, in terms of letting the reader inhabit the text, there's always that awareness of making space for the reader. But when you're doing it in when you're reading an essay or when you're writing an essay, it's far more difficult to do, or it's less of a concern. With an essay, you're often, or most essays are, have a point to prove or an argument to make. But this isn't like that. This puts you, the reader, like I felt like I was in the writer's skin reading this, feeling this kind of nervous energy.
There's that passage of lying in the bath and looking at the pipes and thinking how elegant the pipes are. Mm. And the pipes are, obviously, on some level, the pipes are the pipes, but the pipes are also, it seems to be metaphorical about her own style. So she says the pipes don't begin here and the pipes don't end here, that we just see a small segment of the pipes. And a Claire Louise Bennett story or essay or piece of writing, and one of the delicious things about her work is that none of the stuff that she writes fits comfortably into any of those kind of categories. But it feels like you're seeing a kind of middle section of a story and you're not seeing the beginning, you're not seeing the end. And I thought that, I thought that's amazing. I do really like the fact that you're never entirely sure what it is. I mean, it starts out as a conventional memoir. And I read it when I remember reading it for the first time thinking, okay, well, this is just a memoir about going to college. And then it flips. And it uses the quote from Tennyson as this flip. She has this image where she remembers drawing chalk waves on the wall with chalk from a pool table. And then the piece flips and it stops being a simple memoir and it becomes this treatise on aesthetics that she uses, that Tanizaki's book In Praise of Shadows, as this point of access into this treatise on aesthetics and on the sort of competing virtues of light and shadow.
It does. It turns at the mention of Tanizaki, but it seems to me like an essay that has several kind of sudden turns, sudden left turns. I'm thinking of the scene in which she is in the bath. The first reference to baths. I drew baths that were so hot I got giddy right away and thought I'd pass out and perhaps drown. And then that, without any explanation, right, writing with just complete a kind of wonderful innocence, authority, honesty, emotional honesty, she's just taking things a little bit. It goes beyond a little bit my first year of college there. And then a page on, there's that amazing vision of a man on a horse on Putney Heath, dressed in silver red livery. No need to explain to you. Just here's this image of a man on a horse with a weapon on a foggy afternoon. And then, of course, there's the Tanizaki.
But what I actually really love that a piece of writing. And some of my favorite pieces of writing and some of my favorite poems and stuff are that begin somewhere and end somewhere else.
Yeah.
And you find yourself exiting the text thinking, how in the name of God did I get here? How did we start there? And how did we get there? But I'm glad you mentioned that moment. The man on the horse and Putney Heath and fog. It's like this kind of wonderfully ancient image in the middle of it, that you're absolutely right, gets no introduction except for the fact that she mentions moving into Putney Heath. We get this image of Putney Heath, and then we exit the image without any kind of contextualization of the image and then the sort of story resumes again. Yeah, there is something at the kind of the cognitive process of the thing that it sort of disappears into itself.
Yeah.
And sort of surfaces almost in tandem with the reader, as if to say, okay, where was I? Yeah, then in year three, you know. And I love that. I think it's flits all over the place, and it drifts so that, you know, and this is one of the things that somebody said once, that's not my kind of phrase, but somebody said that, you know, basically the best literature is in itself a process of creating the taste by which it is to be appreciated.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah.
And there is, you know, something about Claire Louise Bennett, because I'll be honest with you, when I read this stuff first, when I read Pond, I did a reading with her in Cork in 2018. She thought she was lovely with great crack at the meal afterwards and stuff, but I couldn't make head nor tail of the work.
Yeah.
No, I wrote to her about a year later saying, you know, I can't get this out of my head. Like, I just, you know, I didn't like it greatly, but it stayed with me, and I have read it so many times now, and I've thought, wow, this is amazing. But it is, like the best of literature, a process of instruction, of creating. It is teaching you how to read itself, basically. And it doesn't do the simple kind of structure of plot, but it drifts, and it teaches you how to appreciate the drift.
But drifts with utter confidence, which I think is, it's the thing I'm probably most jealous of in Claire Louise Bennett's writing, is the absolute authority with which she goes completely wild on the page, linguistically, I mean, just really lets it all there for you. I think it's very difficult to achieve. But it's really interesting that you mentioned struggling with it at first, but it not leaving you, because we had, as far as I remember, we had June Caldwell on a number of episodes, maybe a couple of years
that.
Ago.
I heard that, actually. Yeah,
and she said a similar, she picked Claire Louise Bennett as well, and said roughly a similar thing, that she wasn't sure what to make of it at first, but it stuck with her, it wouldn't let her go. And that's a direct result of that high wire act, isn't it? Some writers take risks knowingly or not. They take these risks, and there's a lot to be lost in terms of, you can leave people behind, you can leave readers behind, but the readers that you hang on to, the ones that are able to take it in, or the ones that it doesn't leave, you have them forever. You know what I mean? Like, and like you say, impossible to emulate.
One of the things I really like about it is it's really mean-spirited. You know, I actually, you know, seriously, it's a beautiful piece, and ultimately it is not mean-spirited, but there's something deliciously petty about it. She keeps having cracks at various things. Her philosophy teacher, Roehampton College, where my dear wife taught one, and she turns down no opportunity to sort of stamp all over these little petty grievances from the past. And sometimes I think, especially in Irish writing, we concentrate too much on being sound, on being nice guys in writing.
Being liked.
And to come across a piece of writing like this that is so deliciously petty and mean-spirited and is not even apologetic about it, you know, as opposed to this run-of-the-mill, big-hearted decency that seems to form tonally so much of Irish writing. I found actually ultimately really refreshing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Withering. Withering was the word I'd written at a certain point. Just said, oh, so withering. Yeah. I'll tell you what made me laugh out loud was, it was on the arrival at Roehampton. There's a line about the other students. I'll just read it. In fact, as it turned out, a great many of them like nothing more than to sit in the middle of their beds in the middle of the day watching Australian soap operas cross-legged with the door wide open. I kid you not, I spent at least a year and a half, the first year and a half of my English and philosophy degree, watching Home and Away on the couch, albeit awesome. Not in the middle of the bed, but I skipped brilliant lectures to watch Home and Away. Why? I don't remember. But when I was laughing out loud reading that, thinking it's as if she was standing in the door frame, giving me a particular look many years afterwards. But I didn't go to Roehampton College, so it's not me.
I actually find some of the language that she chooses I mean, it's almost as if she's daring you to say, you know, you can't use these words. This is way overwritten. It's almost as if she's pushing it to, and the way she's pushing it is really kind of funny almost. The views I'd come upon, the crepuscular light, the animated hush, the slinking patina and recurring Faronier, whatever in the name of God that is. Do you know?
Yeah.
It's almost as if, you know, she's kind of daring you to say, I mean, yeah, I suppose not to sort of compare, but if you encounter this within a creative writing student, you'd be sort of saying, oh, be very careful of that. You mustn't do stuff like that.
There's a classic.
You might delete some of these adjectives.
The classic Stephen King line, never say defecate when you can say shit or something like that. She's just wonderfully, unapologetically throwing all that stuff back in her faces and writing beautifully without compromise, without apology. Which is again, like as we've kind of said a couple of times, very rare. I want to ask you. So, how do you take this on? So you admire this writing, and we're both writers ourselves. I think we both teach fiction. Is there something that you can take from this in your own work? Like you said, you'd never try to emulate it, but does it make you up your game in particular ways? Does it force you back?
Yeah. No, I think in some level, I think that one of the things I've kind of come to think of over the years is that any idiot can write an elegant sentence. You know, any fool can write elegant prose. It is taking a risk to actually do something that is beyond the merely competent to achieve something that is original and extraordinary. That's a big risk. If you read something like this, if a piece like Suddenly a Duck had been done by somebody else and had been pitched even fractionally differently, it could have been, as a piece of writing, an absolute disaster. But I think what I really admire about this and what I learn from it as a writer is, on some level, it is really important to come across writers like this who are clearly risking making themselves look really petty or foolish or bad in order to achieve something original and extraordinary. I mean it genuinely. There are passages in here that I think that's just terrible. But, you know, so that it manages to be brilliant, it manages to bypass the merely good to be brilliant. It manages to be brilliant without being in lots of places terribly good. And I think that's tremendously brave. So she's doing the thing that we say as writers, we all say, this is what I want to do. I want to risk writing something really bad in order to write something extraordinary. But most of us, when it comes down to it, we sort of hedge our bets and make sure at least we'll have something that's fair to middling or good. She doesn't do that. She, you know, she really, really goes for it.
Going back to the Tanizaki, the kind of the shift towards Tanizaki, and there's the Charles Moore introduction. One of the basic human requirements is the need to dwell, and one of the central human acts is the act of inhabiting. And that's actually something that I thought about a lot, to do a kind of a segue, but I still want to talk about Claire Louise Bennett. In your own work, there the sense of place in Nothing on Earth, certainly, but in We Are Not in the World Too, it seems to me a new, strange level. The awareness of a sense of space in the work. There's a kind of We Are Not in the World for people who haven't had a chance to see the copy yet or tweets about it or whatever. It's about a man and his daughter driving a lorry, a haulage lorry, from England to France. He's not really a truck driver as such. And they both have, there's trauma on both sides of their conversations. But it's like, it's psychogeography to me, but at its most intimate. And it comes down to your awareness of place, of a sense of, I'm talking about imagery, I'm talking about sensory language, all that kind of stuff, but an openness to it and letting the reader kind of inhabit it. And I think she does that. She does it, Claire Louise does it in this essay, in terms of, we talked about the pipes, and we talked about, you know, Tanizaki's, the ideas of Tanizaki and inhabiting.
The image that sticks with me in the pipes is that she's lying in the bath, looking up, trying to imagine the dust on the other side of the pipes. And I thought that was an absolutely amazing image, that it's this kind of sort of, you know, a very, very close camera into all of these tiny little crevices of space that are on some level, as you say, this kind of psychogeography. But one of the things I actually really appreciate about this is her appreciation of grime,
yes,
of dirt,
yeah,
of filth, of the grubby little spaces that sort of are almost within close proximity of any of us in the houses and the spaces that we choose to live in, you know.
It reminded me a lot of several David Lynch moments, in terms of, if you ever noticed David Lynch in, say, for example, in Twin Peaks, the focus on a particular area, like the landing at the top of the stairs, suddenly becomes, the scene is about something else, suddenly there's this focus on that. Or I remember in the newer Twin Peaks, there was a scene, it goes into about 5 or 7 minutes of this guy just sweeping a floor. And it just takes on that, having that laser focus on the place, on some aspect of the place, the grime, the corners, the pipes.
But it's also, it's the material surface.
Yeah.
It's the material surface and this attention to the strangeness and weirdness and uncanniness of these simple, everyday little crevices and material surfaces. The thing that I had in my head was, I just rewatched the Steve McQueen film Hunger about,
yes,
Bobby Sands with Michael Fassbender. And I think there's a minute long sequence where a guy is sloshing down with disinfectant the corridor.
Yes.
And the camera holds it. And it's a sort of, you know, there's a delicious tedium about it.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the things that I actually, just to come back to Claire Louise, is this sort of tedium and imminence, this sort of numinous nature of these little things and surfaces and spaces and crevices and shelves and the sort of the delicious griminess of that. I loved, for example, the bucket of sick.
Yeah.
You know, if there was one thing I would steal out of this, coming shortly to a novel, a Conor O'Callaghan novel near you, would be a bucket of sick. I just thought it was amazing, the fact that the bucket of sick freezes throughout the winter and then softens up in the spring.
Well, that's the genius, isn't it? The thawing out of the sick again is the level. That's where it's clever to have a bucket of sick. It's very, very clever to have it freeze in the winter. It's genius to have it defrost again to be there.
Once again, the following year, the sloppy sick is still sitting there. Oh, dear. Just amazing. But it's this kind of delectation of grime. I do really love that text, the Tanizaki text, In Praise of Shadows, and it's about precisely what she taught. It's about the sort of undersides of things. It's about this, you know, Japanese aesthetic that's predicated on the sort of balance, the harmony between light and shadow, and how the visible is only really kind of can only be appreciated in the context of what is invisible behind it.
Mm.
And I think the way she uses that as a sort of treatise on, you know, hygiene and using light as hygiene and sort of illuminating all of these dark crevices with hygiene is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
The way she connects that to her grandmother and her great-grandmother is just amazing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, we've talked about kind of the sudden left turns and following her own path in the essay. Of course, it is structurally brilliant because she does tie that darkness back into a sense of inner life, a sense of psychological darkness, what was done to her grandmother and great-grandmother. It feels almost glib or unfair to kind of say it's a structurally brilliant turn, because it's, of course, it's testimony, it's memoir. She's bearing witness to things that happened to her ancestors. But it really does. It kind of, we talk about the essay taking left turns, but it comes back around so powerfully,
amazingly.
So
this image of light,
seriously and beautifully. The images of darkness and light.
Yeah, really extraordinary. I mean, I thought the ending was absolutely breathtaking, the way it comes back around. But it's delight. I suppose why I chose this is I find it delightful in the sense that it's sufficiently far enough away from myself and who I am as a writer and what I do that I don't feel so jealous of it that I think I could, I should be doing this.
Yeah.
I couldn't possibly do this. I couldn't possibly even come near doing this. So I feel a sort of, you know, a delightful weightlessness in relation to it. I can appreciate it just beautifully. And I think, wow. And I'm so glad that there's somebody out there doing amazing stuff like this.
Yeah. And there's a lovely summary that I kind of noticed as you were rereading it there. There's early on in the essay, she talks about the kind of the force of literature. If literature has the force to shape you, not your beliefs necessarily or even your outlook, but something far more intimate and formative, the sorts of men you're drawn to, for example, the way you experience desire, then objective analysis seems trite and rather irrelevant. So we've obviously just spent a deal of time on objective analysis, but it is something to say about, like, this is her literature, this piece of literature does that. It has the ability to shape me. It shapes the way I think about things in very, very subtle ways. I'm not necessarily walking with this going, now I think about life as X instead of Y. All of my interactions with people long afterwards. I remember I was actually in this issue, so I got to read this when it came out, and remember being affected by it for quite a while.
And
not like constantly not thinking about it all day, but coming back to it again. And I have, you know, my own book ultimately had things about darkness and light. And I wonder if subtly it's because I read this essay. Maybe it's a number of things.
You reckon that it possibly entered the tapestry of your own work.
Of your own imagining, of your own experience and things like that. So it's wonderful that she talks about what literature has the ability to do to someone. And this is a piece actually that I think does it to anyone who reads it or gets to listen to it via the podcast.
I Googled, can I just say one last thing?
Of course.
I Googled the quote, wave after wave, each mightier than the last. And I knew I recognized it. It's from Tennyson. But it also occurs in a Kate Bush song.
Lovely.
And I kind of thought that was just perfect.
Yeah.
That Claire Louise Bennett was a sort of exact midway point between Alfred Lord Tennyson and Kate Bush. And the way she uses it in the piece as this kind of threshold to flip the thing into a whole other area is just amazing.
And again, without excuse, without explanation, you can look that stuff up on your own time. What matters here are the words. Remarkable essay. I should say that Claire Louise Bennett's Pond is still available on the Stinging Flies website, and her latest book, Fish Out of Water, is also available from Juxta Press. And of course, finally, mark your diaries for Conor O'Callaghan's We Are Not in the World. That's out in February from Doubleday Books. You'll get it in all the usual bookshops. And as I've kind of sort of hinted at, it's a really, really special novel. Conor, thanks a million for joining us.
Cheers, Danny.
I really appreciate your time. And it was a lovely, lovely chat. And to listeners, thanks again for tuning into the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please do subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also subscribe to the magazine itself via our website, or you can order issues via the website or your local bookshop. We're very grateful for financial support from the Arts Council. And of course, we're always grateful to our producer, Ian Malini, who puts these podcasts together each month. Thanks a million and take care.